Support for WKAR is provided by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Current State for Wednesday. Glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. We have a really amongst the most interesting, varied programs that we've had yet. Author David Shields coming up later in the hour. He is the author of How Literature Saved My Life, and he is an advocate of hybrid storytelling. It's a really interesting idea regarding the narrative of literature, the narratives of literature. We also learn more in our Neighbors in Action segment today about the Hospice of Lansing, who is doing some great work in town. All of that is coming up. At the top of the show here, though, 40 years ago, shortly after a tour of duty in Vietnam, Roy Bourgeois had just embarked on a new career, Catholic priest. His life since then has been one of controversial liberal activism. He founded the Schools of the Americas Watch, which monitored the activities of a U.S. center that trains Latin American military officers. He spent 4 years in prison for various protesting activities, then excommunication for his support of the ordination of women to the Catholic priesthood. Mr. Bourgeois is in East Lansing for a showing tonight of the movie Pink Smoke Over the Vatican at the Hanna Community Center. The movie makes the case for the ordination of women. Roy Bourgeois is joined by Lansing's Katie Doyle, a lifelong Catholic who wanted to be a priest as a young person and is following this discussion very closely. Roy and Katie, welcome to Current State.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you.
Is the ordination issue the one you're most involved with now, or are there others?
Well, really, wherever I speak, folks get the package deal in a way. I'm still, because of my time spent in Bolivia, 5 years working with the poor in Bolivia after being ordained, and then in El Salvador, where friends were raped and killed, four church women in 1980 were raped and killed, two of them of the Marino Sisters community. And that brought many of us into that issue of the School of the Americas. Soldiers trained at this school were responsible for their rape and murder, along with Bishop Romero, the Jesuits, and many, many others. So I'm still really working with the grassroots movement to close the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning. And more information on that is soaw.org. But it was in that struggle, confronting the injustice of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, that I met this injustice much closer to home, in my church, the exclusion of women to the priesthood. And meeting so many devout women really made me reflect on the basic question, why wouldn't women be ordained? I mean, as Catholics, we profess that men and women are created equal, of equal worth and dignity. As priests, we all say, including the Pope, that the call to be a priest is a gift and comes from God. So the question I began to ask myself and fellow priests was a very important one. Who are we as men to say that our call from God is authentic, but your call as women is not? And what I discovered in my church was a church teaching that was rooted in sexism. Mm-hmm. And helping me reflect on that was my experience of many years growing up in Louisiana, 12 years of segregated schools, worshiping in a Catholic church where the last five pews were for the black members. That was racism, and we justified it by saying it was our tradition, separate but equal. And so what we have here, I see, is something very, you know, connected. And what I see is sexism, like racism, like homophobia, and all of these other forms of discrimination, mm-hmm. are, you know, it's immoral, it's wrong, it's a sin, and it must change.
I see that a New York Times CBS News poll shows 7 out of 10 U.S. Catholics support ordination for women. How big a factor is public opinion?
Oh, very big. I mean, I reminded the Vatican when I received a letter 3 years ago, and from my own Marino community that I've been a member of for 46 years, warned that if I did not recant my public support for the ordination of women, I would be excommunicated. I reminded them that I'm not this lone voice crying in the wilderness. The majority of Catholics, according to the CBS poll and many other polls, 70% of Catholics want women priest. The problem, of course, is with this, and I've been a member of that all-boys club, a very powerful, privileged, all-male clerical culture. We see women, not all, but many priests, I would say the majority, would see women as a threat to our power, would view women as lesser than men. And this is what we would call prejudice. Let me just say, we have lost our way. And the reason there is such a crisis in the Catholic Church, it's not just about the sexual abuse scandal, which was horrific, which really shook the church to its very core. But the real problem today is we as men continue, just recently, telling the nuns, the women, religious, that they must fall in line, reminding them that they are inferior, that only men are the authentic teachers in faith and morals. And most Catholics, of course, because of the sexual abuse scandal, would say, who are you as men to be claiming to own the church, to speak for God? Mm-hmm. Where are the women? Where are the women?
Katie Doyle, tell us about wanting to be a priest as a child and what you make of this issue in 2013.
Well, thank you for allowing us to speak. And I grew up with a mother who was Episcopalian and a father who was Roman Catholic. And my mother converted and, became a pastoral minister and worked in the church. And from the time I was very young, she was always on Sunday, would be up on the altar, perhaps cleaning up or that sort of thing, helping out in the church. And when I was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, I remember being up on the altar with her after a service. And I said, Mom, I want to be a priest when I grow up. And I remember her whipping around and saying, oh, no, you can't, Katie. That's only for men. And then she sort of stepped back. But that image and that idea stayed with me that only men were allowed to celebrate this tradition, which I still do hold close to my heart in terms of the ritual and the community, but in terms of how the church manifests itself, the church with the big C, I have issues with and cannot keep close to my heart.
So you let that dream go at a young age or more recently?
Oh, at a young age, I think okay. I let it go. Okay. I had struggles when I was growing up. I became married and was divorced and then not accepted in the church as a divorced woman as well, in some ways. It's an insidious problem, I think.
Back to the public support issue, though. Can public support, Roy Bourgeois, can public support of women in the priesthood get the Vatican to a tipping point any faster, or is the institution simply too inflexible for that?
I don't think it's any one cause that's going to bring about this church reform. The church, Catholic Church, is in a serious crisis today, along with the sexual abuse scandal, of course, that really reminded people, you know, that there was something unhealthy with the church, the way priests were worshipped, really. And that blind trust and that blind obedience to authority began to be questioned now. But here's another issue. When I entered, after Vietnam into the seminary, we had over 300 seminarians. This is the 60s, and we had three seminaries to prepare our priest of the Marino order to be priest and to be ordained. Today we have 10 seminarians. Our three seminaries are closed. I mean, mm-hmm. The all-male celibate priesthood has gone the way of the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. It's a time that of the past. Today, what people want is a church where men and women, we don't have this clericalism. We don't have priests put on this pedestal and treated as gods and angels.
Yeah.
This is not healthy.
And when you think about Lansing as well, too, I know that we have since April, there have been 12 announced changes of pastors and churches for the Lansing Diocese. And of these 12, only four will actually be replaced by priests or pastors. There will be two of them that will have priests that serve as administrators and work in several parishes to administrate the parishes. But we've lost, you know, a pastor in a parish that shepherds the people. So why can't that shepherd be a woman? There are already women priests. There was a woman named Ludmila Javorova. I apologize if I pronounce her name incorrectly, but there's a great book by Mary and Therese Winter called Out of the Depths. She was ordained during the Czechoslovakian Cold War by a bishop to serve, and these were people that were underground during the Cold War because, of course, Catholicism and religious practice was a difficult thing at that time. Mm-hmm. And the world is changing.
Roy Bourgeois, I understand you have been somewhat encouraged by the election of Pope Francis. Still, Francis announced on Monday that he plans to continue a hardline approach to reforming one group that represents some 80% of American nuns. This is, you may have alluded to this earlier, this is the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, or LCWR. Pope Benedict felt the group was promoting, quote, radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith, unquote. Are you less optimistic than you were a month ago?
You bet. When I read that article yesterday in the New York Times, I must say this glimmer of hope really diminished. I mean, it's another experience. You know, to be very honest, I was cautiously optimistic. I will, of course, appeal my excommunication by Pope Benedict just for 4 months ago when I received this call from the headquarters.
You will? Okay.
I will appeal it, yes. But I must say, because of the statement in the press yesterday, when Pope Francis affirming, you know, the reprimand by Pope Benedict of the women religious. But it really shows, though, once again, how, you know, men view women. They are inferior. They are not, because they are women, able to interpret the scriptures and question the church's teachings about women, about birth control, about women in the church. And what we have here is really the core of the crisis. Men are saying to women, we are your bosses, we are superior, you are inferior. This is what we used to call in the seminary as heresy.
Katie Doyle, when mm-hmm. when you encounter a Lansing area Catholic who resists the mm-hmm. idea, do you encounter Lansing area Catholics who are part of the 3 out of 10 who resist the idea of the ordination of women in the church? What are those conversations like?
Yes, I haven't had conversations per se, but I have stood my ground with a sign in front of the cathedral, for instance, saying, you know, and got some looks from people who had been coming into service during masses, the ordination mass last year. And that's okay. I mean, part of this is the discussion about how this changes. And, you know, when you talk about the Pope, you know, saying these things about women, you know, we look at the family, men and women. Women guide our children all the time. We have to allow another perspective. Why can't women lead in spiritual guidance as
Very
well?
Very good. We have to leave it there. Great discussion. Roy Bourgeois is in East Lansing tonight. Pink Smoke Over the Vatican at the Hanna Community Center. And Katie Doyle, thank you both.
If I could just mention my booklet, My Journey from
Quickly.
Silence to Solidarity.
And
Very
it's
good.
Great. Thank you so
Very
much
good.
For having
Thanks
us.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
The first ever Michigan State University Science Fair is underway. It's a chance for learners of all ages to explore the science that touches our everyday lives. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with two organizers of the event, Hiram Fitzgerald, Associate Provost of Outreach and Engagement at MSU, and Renee Leone, the coordinator of the MSU Science Fair.
Central to the event is a large expo tent, 40 feet by 140 feet, filled with numerous hands-on activities, demonstrations from all different disciplines for people to enjoy. We also, however, have numerous seminars, demonstrations, discussion panels going on throughout the festival. and they are in various classrooms around campus. We have open houses as well, so facilities such as the Cyclotron and FRIB are open, as well as other familiar locations such as the Bug House, and the museum has special exhibits and presentations going on, MSU Museum. And so they'll be going on also on the weekends, but primarily in the evenings, because that is when parking lets up and is more available. However, if you venture into campus during the week, during the day, you'll also find a variety of things to do. Again, we have ICER supercomputers open for tours and presentations. We have the Center for Advanced Microscopy. It's a mouthful to say, but they have super advanced microscopes that are really fascinating to see, and we have an opportunity to see that. And so all 10 days, there'll surely be something for you to find, to do, and discover on campus.
What age group of kids are you targeting?
We are targeting all lifelong learners. So children, adults, seniors, everybody. We have a special day, however, geared towards schools, because the promotion of STEM sciences are really important to us. But we know that people of all ages are curious about this. But on Friday the 19th, we have pre-registered, and it is full at currently. We had a wonderful response from local schools. We have about 19 schools, 1,300 students scheduled to come for special activities, presentations, and most of them are taking time in the expo tent as well. So we are excited to be able to invite all these children in.
Yeah, I'm High Fitzgerald, Associate Provost of Outreach and Engagement within the Office of the Provost. And my role in this is to be a cheerleader, to help with the funding process and to orient the staff of University Outreach and Engagement to invest their time and energy into helping to make all this happen. So we have the folks from the Wharton Center for Performing Arts. We have our staff here from the various units that are involved. The MSU Museum for Cultural and Natural History is involved. And all of these folks have pulled together to help provide the support infrastructure so that Renee can help make all this happen.
Why is it important to get students interested in science, especially at science at MSU?
It's the survival of this country, if you want the broad answer, the deep answer. Being interested in science means we have to do a better job in pre-K to age 25 in our educational system. So we have literate people. We have people who understand mathematics and people who are fascinated and engaged in innovation and discovery related to all the sciences, not just the natural sciences, but the social, the economic, the life sciences, all the areas that provide mechanisms to get evidence to support the kinds of knowledge that will advance us as a society. So it fits University Outreach and Engagement as a support unit in the Provost Office, because our job is to help all 4,900 academic staff and faculty on this campus who wish to connect the university's mission with partners in communities. And this is really what it's all about. This is inviting everybody in mid-Michigan, throughout Michigan, to come to this campus and to discover that many of the things that they think about in terms of science are not quite as mysterious as they may think, that it pervades every aspect of their life, not just getting people to the moon, but, you know, getting in your car and driving to work involves an enormous amount of science and technology. So it's all those facets that we think will excite them and hopefully create a different sense in the public as to what their role is in helping to create better educational systems and more innovation in their own kids and their own lives.
It does seem like from the time, you know, one of my earliest memories was the moon landing. It does seem like from that time that a lot of the enthusiasm for many kinds of science, as you said, not just getting men to the moon, has sort of eased off. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
Yeah, well, you know, stuff happens. I'm older than you are, so it was Sputnik in my age. So, you know, when the old Soviet Union put a little thing up there around wow, the United States and many other places, but especially the United States, responded diligently and significantly in enhancing investments into science and technology. Then we've gone through other sort of errors, and now all of a sudden we're discovering that we didn't sustain that, and we didn't try to take it to scale. And in many respects, we're now not even close to number one in a whole lot of areas where we ought to be. Yeah, we have a lot of number one things here on this campus. Our other public universities in Michigan have number one things, but we don't have number one educational systems in this country. And that's from bottom to top, or from the earliest ages to now. And we can go out and celebrate folk festivals and dance and sing and enjoy music. We can have jazz festivals. We have blues festivals. But we don't celebrate the core of what enables this society to continue to have those things. And that's the science and technology that drives the 21st century knowledge economy.
It seems like one common thread when you hear the biographies of famous scientists is that they got a chance to be a little bit creative as children, maybe taking some things apart that maybe they should or shouldn't have, or maybe being able to observe nature in a way that a lot of kids don't have a chance to now. How important do you think it is for kids, you know, really under the age of high school to kind of get their hands on stuff, just get immersed in it?
Is as important for every kid at every age as it is to babies, because that's how babies discover the world. I'm a baby guy. I'm a developmental psychologist, and I have 46 years of studying babies and toddlers, and that's how they discover the world. They touch things. They lick things. They taste things. They pull on things. They try to put their fingers in the plugs in the wall. They do all these crazy things because they are driven because of our species to explore and experience their environments. And so we do a lot to try to socialize that into constructive and positive ways so they, you know, don't harm themselves. But along the way, we sort of forget that touching and tasting and seeing and hearing and exploring are critical throughout life. Those are the kinds of things and the adventures that we want to try to assure continue to happen. We've developed educational models sometimes that suppress that. These are opportunities to express it instead of suppressing. We want to express, and they can do it here in a good, safe environment, but one that's going to, as we hope, wow them.
I do want to just add that the Science Festival is free and open to the public, and which is just an extraordinary thing. You know, everybody has access to this, and it's a wonderful opportunity to really get to know and interact with the scientists themselves and realize that they are just like you and me, and to get a glimpse, too, at the breadth of science disciplines that we just don't always realize are out there, and how they interact with each other and overlap. For instance, many people are familiar with paleontology, others are familiar with botany, but paleobotany, wow, I'm interested in that. And others might discover just how different interests tie together in careers that they hadn't even thought about. And as you were speaking before, in regards to education and learning and science education and where that's going for children, Dr. Fitzgerald mentioned the hands-on element of it, and it's just, that's what this is about. You know, it's interactive, it's hands-on as much as possible, and it's interactive. So talking with these scientists is there for you to explore. So we hope everybody enjoys it and comes and has a great time.
That was the coordinator of the MSU Science Fair, Renee Leone. We also heard from Hiram Fitzgerald, Associate Provost of Outreach and Engagement. They spoke with WKAR's Melissa Benmark. The MSU Science Festival runs through April 21st, and for a link to the schedule, visit wkar.org. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up in the program, we learn more about Hospice of Lansing during our Neighbors in Action segment here on Current State. Our next guest is a prolific writer who has some strong feelings about the directions in which literature should be heading. And just a little hint, we're not quite there yet. David Shields is the Milliman Distinguished Writer in Residence at the University of Washington and the author of 14 books, including his most recent work, which is entitled How Literature Saved My Life. He's speaking tonight at 7 p.m. in Wells Hall on the MSU campus, and he joins me now to talk a little more about writing and literature. Welcome to East Lansing, David Shields.
Thanks, Mark. Very good to be here.
Very nice to see you. In your project, as you call it, you have interesting ideas about narrative, about the ways that stories can be told. Was this the result of some degree of frustration with traditional ways of telling stories?
I would say yes. I even talk about it at length in the book. I talk about how that I began as a novelist. I've written three novels. I was trying to write a fourth novel. This was maybe 15 years ago. And I found myself extraordinarily bored with the conventions of the novel. And I took a strong left turn into what I call literary collage. And that is what I have been writing over the last 15 years. I've become convinced that the conventions of conventional storytelling no longer capture what it feels like to be alive now. They seem to me, in many ways, the conventions of the 19th century. The glacial pace of the conventional novel, the foregrounding of setting as if where we live matters as much to us as it did to Balzac, a kind of Freudian psychology that doesn't take advantage of what we know about behavior through cognitive science, and above all, a sense that the world makes sense, that God's in his heaven organizing life, and that we can write a sort of Dickensian or Tolstoyan novel in which everything all coheres.
Was there a model for this kind of approach in your head? You have pointed out, for example, that Shakespeare openly acknowledged that he lifted from Plutarch. James Joyce, you refer to as a scissors and paste man or something like, and he acknowledged that he himself was one of those kinds of people. Are there examples of what you are yearning for here that are already in play?
Absolutely. And in many ways, I would argue it goes back to ancient civilization. I would say Heraclitus's Fragments are very much like this. I think Blaise Pascal's Pensées are like this. Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, in many ways, the first novel is like this. In many ways, I'm trying to recover a very alive literary tradition that goes back millennia and try to apply it now to convey what it's like to live at ground level now. I also have many contemporary writer friends, fellow travelers, fellow collagists who are doing very similar things. I think of Maggie Nelson, Amy Fusselman, Sarah Manguso, Simon Gray, Spalding Gray, David Markson, J.M. Coetzee. There's a whole gaggle of us who, to me, are trying to push the art form forward. You know, art, like science, should progress. Culture changes. Forms die. Art moves forward. And, you know, as V.S. Naipaul said, if you want to write seriously, you have to be willing to break the forms.
Well, for our listeners who are acclimated to the conventions as you describe them, can you and who may be unfamiliar with some of the writers that you've just mentioned, can you give us some idea of a result? Can you talk in even general terms about the effect of this kind of literature?
Sure. I think a good example would be a book I seem to like to mention a lot because it so perfectly exemplifies what I'm talking about. And that's a short work of nonfiction, a work of what I call collage book-length essay by Maggie Nelson called Bluets, spelled B-L-U-E-T-S. It's a very short book. Many of these books I'm championing, the books I tend to write and read and teach tend to be quite brief. And Maggie's book, as is mine, as are many of these books, is a short book. It's about 120 pages. It's built up about 240 prose fragments. And I think to the casual reader, it might look like a writer's diary or a writer's journal. But it has three specific strands. One strand throughout the book is about Maggie Nelson's obsession, believe it or not, with the color blue, that she talks on and on about how she's obsessed with the color blue. And you might say, yawn, that doesn't interest me. But she connects her obsession with the color blue to her grief over her incapacity to get over the end of a particular love affair. And then there's a third strand, in many ways the most interesting strand of the book, has to do with her sadness about her friend who has recently become quadriplegic through a car accident. And you might think, what does the color blue have to do with the end of a love affair, have to do with becoming paralyzed? But what she does quite magically and subtly and brilliantly and beautifully is she shows you how these three separate aspects of human life are all connected. That she's asking terribly important questions such as, why are we so sad? Why is the human animal so melancholy? How do we deal with loss? How do we deal with the ultimate loss that is death? What I so love about these books is they ask in a very direct way the most fundamental questions about what we're doing on planet Earth.
Do you find yourself disheartened at all by the immense success of more standard storytelling? Are you disheartened by the wild success of the Harry Potter series, for example? Do you find you as encouraged as you are by this, as enthused as you are by this other form, this advocacy of this other form? Is the flip side of that some disheartenment of at immense success for more standard storytelling?
Well, not exactly. I mean, my daughter's 20, and she grew up with the Harry Potter series, and I would go at midnight at 12:01 to the bookstores, you know, to buy her those books, and she was dressed up as Hermione or whatever. It was delightful, and she came to learn to read through the Harry Potter series. She's a total, you know, Harry Potter kid who grew up with those seven books, and as I've been traveling around the country over the last 3 months, talking about my book, the books people are reading on airplanes, I promise you, are not How Literature Saved My Life. They're big, baggy, triple-decker novels. That's what people like to read. I mean, I'm that sort of Ralph Nader candidate who knows he's not going to win, but who's trying to push the discussion forward. An earlier book of mine, Reality Hunger, A Manifesto, I think has altered to a degree the way that people talk about nonfiction. And How Literature Saved My Life is an attempt to, in a way, take the ideas I talked about in Reality Hunger and apply them directly to a specific book. But I'm trying to alter the conversation and push things forward.
What do you see as the writer's main function in society, larger society, right now?
Well, I really like this idea of David Foster Wallace, who was asked, what's so great about writing? And he said, we're existentially alone on the planet. You can't know what I'm thinking and feeling, and I can't know what you're thinking and feeling. And literature at its best is a bridge constructed across the abyss of human loneliness. And I take that idea very seriously. The work I love, the work I try and do and read and teach and celebrate is work that absolutely foregrounds the question of how the writer solved the problem of being alive. The work I love does nothing less.
David Scheele's most recent book is called How Literature Saved My Life. If you'd like to hear more, he is speaking tonight at 7 p.m. in Wells Hall on the MSU campus. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Thank you, Mark.
Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Wednesday, and it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make the greater Lansing community a better place. Making preparations for a loved one's death can be a stressful and difficult time for families. But with help, a person's final weeks and months can also hold some of the most beautiful and poignant moments in their lives. And for this week's Neighbors in Action segment, we feature the Hospice of Lansing, which helps families cope with the difficulties of end-of-life care. And here to tell us more is John Person, Executive Director of the Hospice of Lansing. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Mark.
Nice to see you. Just so we're all on the same page and there aren't any misperceptions in play, tell us what hospice is.
Okay, sometimes I answer that question by saying what hospice is not. It is not a place you go for the last few days of your life. What hospice is, and Hospice of Lansing specifically, is a community-based nonprofit organization there to serve patients and their families through that end-of-life time, bringing kindness, respect, and quality to end-of-life so people can die at home with dignity, without unnecessary pain, and providing a reduced burden on the caregivers. A lot of the service we provide is really for the families and not just the patients themselves.
How do you know when the right time is to address hospice care? Do doctors help with that? How does that play out?
Doctors often do not. I think if you would ask an oncologist what they think about a patient who dies, they would tell you that that's a professional failure. But studies have shown people that get hospice care actually live longer. And so it is a difficult question to say, when do you throttle back on, you know, invasive therapeutic care to go to palliative care, care for comfort, so people can be at home in the environment they want, they can have the space and time with their loved ones. Dr. Ira Byrak is a physician, writes much about hospice. He has a book, Dying Well, and he talks about the 10 words. So those people can have the conversations where they say, I love you, thank you, I'm sorry, I forgive you, and you know, to close out the business of their life well.
Let's go a little bit deeper into the exact services that you provide. Tell us about those. Tell us how you work with families.
Sure. Well, we would send somebody out to, you know, provide an informational meeting, and then we have physicians, we have a psychologist, nurse practitioners, nurses, home health aides that deal with, you know, daily living, a social worker, counselors. We have music therapy, pet therapy, massage therapy, a team of people that are experts in end-of-life care. We have experts in other medical fields. Here's a team of people that are experts in end-of-life care to provide comfort to people and usher that whole family group through that period.
Despite the somewhat grim reason you're there, I imagine that hospice work must have its share of very poignant and downright beautiful moments. Are there any that stick out in your mind?
It certainly does. You know, we have inpatient, most of our care is in the home, but we have an inpatient facility. We had a husband was there, his wife was with him, and they said he was actually there a year, so due to his good care, he lived beyond the ordinary prognosis of 6 months that you need to be eligible for hospice care. And she said at the end of that, that was the best year of their marriage. And that's really, you know, those are the kinds of stories that keep us going and very poignant and validates the work that we do.
How do other cultures handle end-of-life care compared to us? Is there something to be learned there?
Sure, there absolutely is. The hospice movement began in the United Kingdom in the 60s. The Economist magazine did a survey of worldwide, about 40 developed countries, and the U.S. doesn't come out very well. What we tend to do is a lot of intensive care. About 5% of the Medicare patients consume 50% of the costs in a year, and most of that is the end of life. So we give a lot of intensive care at the end of life, which makes people uncomfortable as opposed to care at home where they want to be.
So time for a redistribution of
it? Yeah, well, sure. I mean, we're not about the money. We're a small nonprofit. We just want to create that environment for people so people die the way they want to. If you ask people how they want to die, they say they want to die at home. What ends up happening is many die in the hospital. And typically there's an event, you know, there's a downturn in their health. a family member, somebody, they call 911. It's a visit to the emergency room. It's an admission to the hospital. And you know the question they're going to ask, when can I go home? Well, nope, we're going to send you to a rehab, and then you're back home. They don't come out healthier than they went in. They go through that several times. And I think you asked the exact right question, Mark. When's the right time to have that discussion? The physicians often will not be the one to raise that issue. People think if there's a referral to hospice, death is imminent. That's not the case. You can have those months, and many people live beyond that six-month prognosis. So it's incumbent upon families, really a national dialogue, but it's incumbent upon individuals themselves or their families to raise that question. Where are we? What is the trajectory? When is the right time to talk about a referral to hospice?
How did you end up in this line of work?
Well, I came from the board, actually, to and I was doing legal work and helped Hospice of Lansing with a legal issue and got on their board.
You're an attorney then?
I'm an attorney. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Okay.
When our executive director stepped down, I thought my skill set, you know, we're now in a different healthcare environment, and I thought my skill set, my immediate past predecessor, Lars Egedinissen, was one of the original hospice workers in the United States. He just recently got an award at the Hospice and Palliative Care Association of Michigan. Our team does great clinical care. I'm so proud to work with them.
Sounds rewarding.
It is rewarding, and I just thought my skill set at this point in time can help on the business side of our operation.
What about hospice for young people?
We don't see a lot of it just because parents aren't always ready. But, you know, we had a young gentleman, a four-year-old, and his dream was to go to school, and we provided him some care and comfort, and the school made an exception, and he showed up to school with his oxygen and was showing everybody how that works. And we wish we could help more people because it's the same with children. There comes a point where you say, maybe we should ease back on some of the therapies that may be causing discomfort and really provide comfort, care, and dignity at the end of life.
Can you tell us anything about the broader attitudes throughout the community, throughout the society, about hospice?
Sure. People fear it. And people are, you know, you don't come easily to the idea that you're at end of life. So many people think a referral to hospice means death is imminent. And that simply isn't the case. People actually live longer with that, you know, comfortable care at home because that's what they want to be. And so, you know, as I say, you have to go back and, you know, start that dialogue yourself sometimes and say, where are we? And your physicians will tell you, no, I think we should do something. Your mom should recover from this. That's the way we should go. But they often won't start that dialogue of, you know, we're on that downward trend. There was an article in the New York Times said, hey, if you told somebody, we would send a nurse out 24 hours a day if you need that. They're on call. We'll have somebody help, a home health aide will help with activities of daily living, light cleaning, cooking. There's social workers to help you. Do you want that care? People would say yes. As soon as you attach the hospice name to it, then they go, oh, you know, we're not ready for that. If people were to come to that a little more comfortably, a little sooner, they would be able to enjoy the benefits of hospice care.
I'm sitting here and I can't help but wonder if the hospice experience, when it plays out positively, as it often does, I'm sure, if it doesn't really offer profound lessons for the living who witness this process at the end, you know, toward the end of someone's life and say, you know what, I'm going to live my life differently because
Absolutely.
Of what I've witnessed in a hospice setting.
Absolutely. And we have, you know, sometimes we will serve one, you know, we'll be talking to a child and they'll say, you know, I went through hospice care with mom. I didn't do with that. I wish I had known.
Exactly.
Because it was different. And if you get to the point where the patient understands they're at end of life and they say, I'm ready to go, and the family recognizes that, and they say, we're ready to let go, too, and they have that time together. The experience of death is a gentler, kinder, more dignified, more beautiful process than if people are in an institution, you know, on a ventilator and getting care, which actually is not providing comfort at all.
We're talking with John Person, who's the executive director of Hospice in Lansing, during our Neighbors in Action segment here on WKAR. What are your challenges as an organization?
Well, for small nonprofit funding, significant part of our funding is Medicare, so we are affected by this sequester immediately, and that is significant to us, to say the least. We get $130 to $160 per day to provide those nurses and physicians and home health aides and social workers all the durable medical equipment if you need a bed in your home, all the drugs, all of those things. That doesn't cover that cost. So we need help from the community to help do that. And that's one of our big challenges is to, one, to educate people about what a good life and good dying can be. And to, you know, just keep the doors open.
You've created some real believers in this approach that I imagine talk to other people about it. Is that a valuable network of communicators for the Hospice of Lansing?
Yes, but we appreciate being here because we still don't think the message is out there. We're actually trying to work with MSU Schools of Medicine to say, can we talk to those docs? and they don't teach them about that in medical school so that they know about that.
Yeah.
And that there is a medical discipline, expertise of end-of-life care, and more people should take advantage of that, and they should be aware of that.
Where is the future of the hospice movement in general and here in the greater Lansing area?
Hospice use is becoming more common, although, you know, in America, if more is – some is good, more is better, we find out there's still a lot of use in intensive care units in hospital before going to hospice. A better model might be to think about hospice care earlier, but hospice care is on the rise. And I think, you know, there needs to be some national dialogue on there's significant savings when people use hospice as opposed to more intensive medical care. There's very significant savings. And right now we're kind of in the model of doing both. We do the intensive care and then hospice, as opposed to saying it's an alternative during that last 6 months of life.
Does hospice play out, does the hospice movement play out anywhere else in the national healthcare system? You alluded to its relationship to Medicare a minute ago. Are there other connections, other relationships?
There are. I still think that, you know, our healthcare system is based on you get paid for a service that you provide. It's really a paradigm shift to say maybe we should not provide services and you'll get better outcomes and to look at that. But I still think we have a lot of work to do.
How will the Affordable Care Act impact your work?
It's yet to be seen as they begin to put the accountable care organizations together. Hospices can't be part of creating those organizations, so we're kind of small fish in a big pond, wondering how we are going to fit in. And I'll be at the national meeting next week, and that certainly is a topic of discussion on how are we going to fit in this thing? How's that going to work for us?
Clinically, where are there patterns to where hospice recipients of hospice services, clinically, where do they tend to be at? Are we talking cancer?
It's across the spectrum, certainly, but a good number of our patients are just dementia, debility, Alzheimer's, typical end of life things, and then you certainly have cancer and other things which mm-hmm. accelerate.
How can people get involved if people are hearing this interview and they want to get involved in some way? How can they help you?
We have volunteers, hospiceoflansing.org, or call us at 517-882-4500, and you will reach Hospice of Lansing.
Very good. John Person is the Executive Director of Hospice of Lansing. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We could always use more information, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work, and we don't know about them. If you'd like them to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please get us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss sustainability on MSU's campus. Also, we'll speak with musician Bob Baldore about the film Boogie Stomp. That and more Thursday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Andy Curtis and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by City Pulse, whose mobile app for its digital edition is available for iPhone and iPad. City Pulse is at 470 locations every Wednesday and at LansingCityPulse.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.